talking a little bit out here in the hall before we went on the first time, Dennis and I, and he asked if at the second service I would kind of share a little bit of background of how I happened to come to be here, how I began writing books, because it is not something that I had planned to do. And my story may be somewhat similar to a lot of stories here, in that early on, having come up through the Adventist educational pipeline and grown up in an Adventist home and so forth, I still found myself wondering whether or not really this was all there was to the world. Now, you have to ask these things. You know, you ask yourself basically, is this all the truth there is, or might there be something else out there that's worth exploring? Well, when I was in my senior year of law school, a strange thing happened to me. I was still very much a cultural Adventist, and I would always go somewhere on Sabbath, many times for the simple reason that it was culturally comfortable for me, and I was around an institutional center so I could go and get the kind of food I was used to eating and so forth. And for that reason, on Sabbath and Friday night, frequently if there was something happening, I would go. I freely admit to you folk that one of the reasons why I went to these places was I was hoping maybe I would meet somebody there who was an Adventist and who with whom I could perfect a more complete relationship, you know, get to know them better, and you always have these things going through your mind when you're single. Well, one Friday night, near the end of my senior year at law school, Elder Fagel from Faith for Today came down to San Diego, and he was doing a kind of a quick series of meetings in town. And at that time, I had my life very clearly planned. I knew exactly what I wanted. The first thing I wanted was a 427 Corvette. I was tired of being poor. I had had it up to here with being a poor student, and I knew what I wanted. And it was one of those 1967, you know, deep blue with a scoop on the top, and nothing in this world would ever get ahead of me if I didn't want it there. So anyway, on the way down to Elder Fagel's meeting, I went to the Chevy dealer, three-way Chevrolet down in Mission Valley, and picked up a brochure for the new Corvettes. And then I went on out to the meeting. When I went into the meeting, I took the brochure with me just in case Fagel didn't really ring the bell. And I sat on the back row. This was my accustomed spot. Not only I could get out easy if I got tired of it, but also it's a good place to see people. So anyway, I was sitting there in the back row, and toward the end of the meeting, Elder Fagel did the predictable. He did one of these altar calls where all the sinners are supposed to get up and walk down to the front and get straightened out. And that was something I was in need of at the time, but for a long time, I didn't recognize it. I just tuned him out. He went on and on, begging the people to come forward. And at length, it occurred to me, this man has been doing this longer than is socially acceptable. I mean, he had been doing this for quite a while. And he finally said, look, I want to bring this call to a close, but I can't do it. There is somebody in this room that needs to be down front here. At which point I said to myself, Walton, you idiot, he's talking to you. So I left my Corvette brochure on the seat. I haven't seen it to this day. I went up front with all the rest of the sinners. Well, at that point, the Lord really began to impress on my mind, the thing to do is forget the Corvette, at least for a while, go back to La Sierra, of all places, where I had taken my BA degree, and take some more work in religious studies. Now, I don't have any doubt in my mind that the Lord was calling me to the ministry. I know He wasn't, because I don't have the patience for it. Those who can do it, I really deeply admire, but I don't have that kind of patience. I couldn't run a church board meeting, and it would be just blood on the floor. So what the Lord wanted me to do, I still don't know. And the reason that I don't know is that for 2 weeks, I struggled with this conviction. It didn't fit my plans. Finally, I did what Jonah would have instantly recognized and deeply appreciated. I went down Broadway Street in San Diego, found a Navy recruiter, and I joined the Navy. A decision I soon had reason to deeply regret, but I did it. So for the next 3+ years, I rumbled around the world, thinking naively that the service would take into consideration my legal training and being blissfully ignorant of how they assign personnel. Instead, I found myself roaming the world with intelligence data in sealed bags, carrying a .45 caliber pistol on my hip, which I was required to carry because of the sensitivity of the stuff that I was dealing with. Found myself in the war zone, found myself all over from Labrador all the way to the Straits of Singapore, roaming the world with this stuff. And as I began to see combat, and I began to see humanity at its worst in Southeast Asia, I began for the first time to really rethink the realities that had been presented to me all my life in terms of my religion and what my parents had been trying to say. That there just might be something to the old Advent message besides a bunch of cliches. Well, that kind of cocked the gun. When I got back, finally got out of the service, went into trial law, and saw the same kind of human behavior now in the more genteel arena of the courtroom, but still acting out this hostility of person against person, it finally clicked. And I realized that, in fact, the only hope this world and this race has is back at the cross. So anyway, I became really convicted I should do something, and I wanted to share my convictions with my neighbors, and they were in a community where it's not particularly easy to reach them because most of them have just about everything they think they need and a lot of things they don't. And so you don't just go up to their door and knock on the door and say, "Hi, I'm your neighbor, my name is Lewis, and I have what you need." You know, they don't think they need anything. So I got to thinking maybe it would be nice to print some little color brochures, you know, that really portray the gospel as attractively as General Motors does to try to sell you a car. And from that, I tried to get somebody in the denomination to do that and to write those books, and nobody would. So I finally did it just by default. And that, Dennis, is how Because of You and Thoughts in Springtime came about. Those books are now out of print. They're going to give me back the copyrights, and I just may consider redoing them because I think maybe there's still some folks we could reach. I think it's time to at least recognize what we have to give people has so much class to it, we ought to portray it in a classy way with nice color pictures and good text and so forth. Well, that got me started writing books, and that's in part why I'm here. And one of the books that I wrote that probably got the biggest notice in the church was Omega. And as I've traveled over the last 12 years or so, people have said, "When are you going to do another book like that?" And I'm awful busy, and I enjoy life. I have a lot of distractions. You know, my surfboard still distracts me from doing things I should do. And so it took me a long time, but finally, I got around to writing Omega 2. There it is. It is just off the press this week. That's number one off the press. That's all I've got. And hopefully next week a bunch of them will arrive. And Kathy Newhart is the one, if you should be interested in getting one, American Cassette Ministries has these, and they have a toll-free number, and they're just delightful people to work with, and they can make them available. What I've tried to do is go back and rediscover some of the lessons of history at a time when it's real clear to me Jesus was trying to come at the turn of the century. The only thing that kept it from happening was the people who were supposed to tell the world dropped the ball. That was us in the person of our grandparents and great-grandparents. So the one thing we don't want to do is repeat their mistake, because I think we're there again. Now, tonight, we're going to kind of switch gears. I've been trying to talk with you about things that I thought might be of interest, you know, to this particular group, and we'll try to do that a little bit as we finish this morning's service. But that's not really where my heaviest research lies. My background is in military analysis. I'm a lawyer. I try to look at the world and analyze what's going on, and I can't help as an Adventist comparing all that stuff with prophecy. Tonight, what I'd like to do is give you folk the kind of briefing I used to give admirals on world events, where I think things are going, some areas in respect to religious liberty that I think you need to be aware of, trends in our society. Compare that with some of the stuff that you and I have heard all our lives about what an end-time world will look like, and then let you decide just how serious maybe we ought to get about this thing called the Second Coming. Okay, now let's go back to the topic that I want to cover this morning, and that is, what do you do when you find yourself waiting, as I did for a number of years, waiting for the right person to come along? And there were times when I was lonely. There were times when I was impatient, saying, "Lord, have you forgotten me? I'm still here and I'm still looking. You know, when's it going to happen?" And while we wait for that special relationship to develop, I know from personal experience it is possible to feel some loneliness. But I also know it's possible to be lonely in a crowd and lonely in a marriage. Very possible. So in whatever circumstance we find ourselves, loneliness is something that we will occasionally have to deal with. I suggest that you and I, as a family, because really that's what we are, as we get down into this funnel called the end of time, we will be tempted to feel very lonely because there will be very few people in this world that will agree with us. So, how are we going to deal with this? It seems to me like it might be very nice to just remember that however lonely you may think you are, if you were the only believer on this world, you would still be a vast majority. Because out there beyond the curtain, beyond the realm of mortal sight, is this innumerable host of extraterrestrials. Let's talk about companions in the cosmos. Now, I invite you to turn, as we begin this morning, to 2 Kings chapter 6. And while you're finding that, 2 Kings chapter 6, let me read something to you from Desire of Ages, page 356. The Bible shows us God in His high and holy place, not in a state of inactivity, not in silence and solitude, but surrounded by 10,000 times 10,000s of holy intelligences, all waiting to do His will. Through channels which we cannot discern, He is in active communication with every part of His dominion. This cosmos is absolutely flooded with intelligent beings who are just incandescent with the glory of God coming from and going to the throne. They're in busy activity all the time. The whole cosmos is being managed. It just makes me think of I-5 coming north out of Seattle through Everett on a busy Friday afternoon, but everybody moving at the speed of light. Can you picture it? Now, while we think about these angels, I want to draw our attention back to this little story we're going to quickly go through in 2 Kings 6. You go back to the year 845 B.C., and in the palace in Damascus, there was this king by the name of Ben-Hadad. From that, we know he is the son of Hadad. He's the second one by that name. He is in deep turmoil because it seems that his deepest state secrets are leaking out. Now, having been in a little bit of that kind of war planning and war gaming, I can understand where the guy's coming from. He plans an attack against Judah or Israel. His forces deploy, but by the time they get there, there are blockers in the way. The passes are blocked. His flanks get turned. Everything he does seems to be telegraphed to the king of Israel. Well, if that happens, as the Bible says here in 2 Kings 6 and 10, not once or twice, see, it's happening repeatedly. Pretty soon, you don't have to even be much more than Forrest Gump to figure out somebody's telegraphing information. Information's leaking. So Ben-Hadad pulls in his high command. He says, okay, boys, one of us here is passing information to the king of Israel. I want to know who. And somebody speaks up. And he says, Your Majesty, I don't think the problem is one of us because we're all loyal. Our fortunes lie with you, Majesty. We want Assyria to win. Your problem is over in Israel. Now, does anybody here this morning have an inkling of who it might be who has given that information to Ben-Hadad? Who tells the king this? Got any idea? He's a high-ranking Assyrian officer. He's a general officer. Ever heard of a guy by the name of Naaman? Naaman, his name means pleasant. If anybody in Assyria would have reason to know there's a prophet in Israel, it would be Naaman. Why? Because he's been there and he's seen the power of God. So my hunch is Naaman is the one who tells the king, your problem is a prophet in Israel. Well, the king with remarkable tunnel vision says, well, that's an easy problem to solve. Let's go down there, find out what city he's in, encircle the thing, and we'll either starve him out, burn him out, or wipe him out. That'll solve the problem. And so he sends down his troops down to the city of Dothan, Canaanite city north of Samaria, and the prophet and his servant happen to be in that city. And one morning the prophet says, would you go out, please, and you know, get the water and dump the trash over the wall and come back and fix breakfast. I'm hungry. So the servant goes out and he looks over the wall and he says, uh-oh. You know, this is not going to be a good day. Comes back to the prophet and he says, "Prophet, we have more trouble than we've ever had in our lives. They're all around the city. You know, there are 15 or 20 ranks of them deep. There are burnished shields. There are siege engines. There's everything down there to kill us." And now let's go to 2 Kings 6, 16 and 17. Now here is the prophet's answer. And he answered, "Fear not, for they that be with us are what? More than they that be with them. So that at the end of time or at your workplace or in your apartment when you seem to be alone, you are more than a majority of the rest of the entire world." Okay. Now look at verse 17. Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of what? Fire. This is supernatural. So the forces of Israel will be being defended by supernatural beings. You know, beyond the realm of sight, there's this whole realm of cosmic visitors that are coming and going to this world. They're very interesting individuals. They apparently are very deeply emotional. From the descriptions given in the Bible in the spirit of prophecy, I would tend to say that probably many of them are of a melancholic personality. They seem to be that way. They have deep sympathy. They can sing when a world is created. They can sing when a world is about to be recreated. When the Son of God is going to be born in human tissue, they break forth into song. And sometimes, when they look at how messed up this world is, they can't hold back the tears. They're very remarkable individuals. Well, they're constantly on the move between earth and heaven. They're traveling on a mysterious ladder. What's the ladder they travel on? Huh? It's a person, isn't it? Jesus. Hey, by the way, how far down to this world does that ladder extend? All the way. What good's a ladder if its rungs don't touch the ground? All the way. The Son of God comes all the way into humanity, just blends humanity and divinity. Now angels can travel on him. And so now they travel between heaven and earth, and their function is to help us when we fail. Now, there are a few of us, like myself, that are experts at it. Even want to, you know, discuss something, like discuss it with an expert. Well, failure is something that some of us have perfected to a fine art. And the angel's function is to help us when we do that. Take a look now over in 1 Kings 19. Let's just back up one book, and we're going to see a man of God who is in the process of failing the Lord. His name is Elijah. He's the precursor to the man we were just reading about. 1 Kings 19. Now, he's just been up on Carmel. He has just lit off a sacrifice drenched with several barrels of water. He has started a mighty revival in Israel. Now, he runs ahead of the king's chariot all the way back to the gates of the city. So this guy is no wimp. He pulls up his big gown and he runs ahead of charging horses all the way back to town, lies down in the gate of the city, pulls his robe around him to endure the shower. He has started what can be the turning point that might turn the whole history of Israel. If he stands his ground here and faces off Jezebel, this may make the difference between the failure of Israel and their success. You know, God's plan for Israel, I don't think, was to have Messiah be crucified by the Jews. He would come to earth and die, but I think his plan was very different. And I almost sometimes wonder if maybe God's original plan was for the first and second comings to somehow merge in some way, so that Israel becomes the lighthouse to the world, and Messiah comes through them, and they are a holy, healthy, happy people who deliver the message God had for them to give. Now, if Elijah stands his ground here, just maybe there's a chance they'll still be able to pull that off. But what happens to Elijah? He's tired, he's wet, he's shivering, he's no doubt hungry. And up comes a messenger with a little note from Jezebel. And saying, "Buster, I have plans for you, and you're not going to like them." What does he do? Pulls his skirt up one more time so his shanks can get out there and really pump leather. And he heads south, south toward the desert. And he runs and he runs a day's journey. Finally, he collapses under a juniper tree, and it comes to him he's failed in his whole mission. 3.5 years of no rain. Who knows how much praying before that? This face-off with the prophets of Baal, and here at the moment of success, he snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Now, under those circumstances, would you tend to get just a little depressed? Well, he was. Let's take a look at what he says down here in 1 Kings 19:4. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, came, sat down under a juniper tree, and requested for himself that he might die. And he said, "It is enough, Lord, take away my life. I'm no better than the rest of them, no better than my father's." Now, at that low point in his life, and all of us on occasion have times when we're kind of down for various reasons. We get discouraged with ourselves or with our circumstances. I knew a woman one time who was very anxious to get married. She may, in fact, have been the model for whom that cartoon was drawn that I showed you this morning, because her ideals were so high, she still hasn't done it. And I guess she's 50 now. So she would sometimes get very discouraged. You know, the right guy just never seemed to come along, although I've seen some awful nice guys come and go that she just didn't quite find were good enough for her. And she would sometimes say, "Lord, I've just had it. Just let me die." People get discouraged. Well, Elijah got that way. And when that happened, who was it came to see him? The next thing he feels is a soft touch on his shoulder. Now, we pick it up here in verse 5. "As he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, an angel touched him and said unto him, Arise and eat." Now, here's what Ellen White does with that in Prophets and Kings. Elijah should not have fled from his post of duty. He should have met the threat of Jezebel with the appeal for protection. Only a few hours had passed since a wonderful manifestation of divine power. Had he remained where he was, standing steadfast, he would have been shielded from harm. The Lord would have given him another signal victory by sending his judgments upon Jezebel. And the impressions made on the king and people would have wrought a great reformation. That could have changed the whole course of history. She goes on to say he lost his hold on God and fled until he found himself in a dreary wasteland. His spirits were crushed, bitterly disappointed. He desired never again to look on the face of men. And I've been in circumstances where I can sure empathize with that. Now, when that happens, look what happens next. I'm still reading now from Prophets and Kings, 166. He felt the soft touch of an angel's hand. Did God forsake Elijah in his hour of trial? No. He loved his servant no less when Elijah felt forsaken than when, in answer to prayer, fire illuminated the mountaintop. And now, as Elijah slept, a soft touch and a pleasant voice awoke him. He started up in terror, but the pitying face bending over him was not the face of an enemy, but of a friend of God. Touching the exhausted man, he said with pitying tenderness, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for thee." Heaven hasn't forgot Elijah, even in his moment of failure. Well, into the experience of all of us, there come moments when we can share those kind of feelings. Prophets and Kings in this same chapter puts it this way. Into the experience of all, there comes times of keen disappointment, days when it is hard to believe that God is still the kind benefactor, when troubles harass the soul till death seems preferable to life. Those are days, might I suggest, when we all need the soft touch of an angel. She goes on to say, it is then that many lose their hold on God and are brought into slavery to doubt. Could we at such times discern with spiritual insight, we would see angels seeking to save us from ourselves, and new faith would spring into being. You have out there a whole army of living, very powerful, very capable, intelligent beings just waiting to be asked. Sometimes, maybe, we don't ask them. Now, as we approach the end of time, I think we're going to have closer and closer contact with angels. Have you noticed how the subject of angels is beginning to be a pop thing these days? In fact, down where I live, and it may be the same here, there are stores. I mean entire stores in malls devoted to angels. You get little figurines, you get books on angels, you get stuff to hang on your wall. this is beginning to come into people's minds. And I don't think that's accidental. I think angels will be a very, very big part of our lives as we near the end. Ellen White has something to say about it, and in this particular talk, I'm using quite a bit of stuff out of Ellen White. Not that it isn't in the Bible, but in this particular instance, it is described so graphically that I kind of hated not to share it with you, because it is so encouraging and so vivid, so very lucidly said. In Volume 9 of Testimonies, she says, as we near the end of time, angels will draw very close to the affairs of God's people. Here are her words. It is impossible to give any idea of the experience of the people of God who will be alive upon the earth when celestial glory and a repetition of the persecutions of the past are blended. They will walk in the light proceeding from the throne of God by means of angels. There will be constant communication between heaven and earth. Well, as we near the end, the angels will be there. Now, when events begin to come to a climax just before the coming of Jesus, we are told that angels will in fact encircle God's people at the close of time. Now, this evening, when we talk about world events and some of the things that I'm seeing in the political world and so forth, I think we may conclude that we're a little closer to some of this stuff than we may have recognized. I share with you the same feelings, the same mixed feelings when I read this stuff and make these analyses, because I too enjoy living in this world. I live well in California. I have most of the toys people want and could ask for. Many of them distract me, quite frankly, and I hope the Lord will give me the good judgment to know when to do something about that. So I'm not urging crisis on. I live well, and I think I can sense where people are coming from when they're not anxious to think about some of these end-time challenges. But I think we also have to be realistic. If it's out there, we might as well recognize it and talk about it. Well, some of these things could, if we weren't a little careful, tend to make us either fearful or perhaps insular. We have the perfect privilege, as we see end-time events coming up, not to feel fear, but to feel joy. The rest of the world, your neighbors, have every right to feel fear when they see some of the things that are coming down. You don't have that right. Why? Because Jesus said when you see these things begin to happen, then you rejoice and look up because your redemption's drawing nigh. Now, one of the things that we have going for us is the ministry of angels at the end of time. And I want to close with this thought. God's faithful praying ones are, at the end of time, shut in with Him. They themselves know not how securely they are shielded. Urged on by Satan, the rulers of this world are seeking to destroy them. But could the eyes of God's children be opened, as were the eyes of Elisha's servant, they would see angels of God encamped about them, holding in check the hosts of darkness. So in all ages, angels have been near Christ's faithful followers. The vast confederacy of evil is arrayed against all who would overcome, but Christ would have us look to things which are not seen, to the armies of heaven. From what dangers, seen and unseen, we have been preserved. Through the interposition of angels, we shall never know until in eternity we see the providence of God. Then we shall know that the whole family of heaven was interested in the family here below, and that messengers from the throne of God attended our steps from day to day. It's a pretty good promise. Thanks.
You've been listening to Attorney Lewis Walton, American Cassette Ministries guest speaker. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. If you have been blessed by this message and other American Cassette Ministry cassettes, please take a moment just now and write to us. We'd love to hear how this ministry has helped you in your spiritual journey. International Copyright 1995, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. Christian ethics prohibit reproduction in any form. For additional cassettes by Attorney Walton or other American Cassette Ministry speakers, or for a free catalog of the finest sermons, music cassettes, CDs, and videos, please place your order as follows. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 1-800-233-4450. For fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. For international orders, dial 717-652-7000. Or you may write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108 in the United States of America. Celebrating 20 years of service to the Seventh-day Adventist Church, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with balanced, powerful messages that will help you in your preparation to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.